Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we unpack fascinating stories and really try to pull out those brilliant nuggets of wisdom that make you see things a bit differently.
Yeah, hopefully.
Today, we're taking a closer look at Ina Garten, you know, the culinary icon who seems to just effortlessly bring elegance and warmth into our kitchens.
The Barefoot Contessa herself.
Exactly. We all know her for those comforting recipes, her famous, "How easy is that?" catchphrase. But her journey to becoming the Barefoot Contessa, that's a story of, well, personal reinvention and courage that's maybe far more unexpected than you might think.
Oh, it really is quite remarkable. And for this deep dive, we've gone beyond just the cookbooks and the TV show. We've meticulously pieced together insights from her extensive public interviews, those sort of subtle autobiographical bits she weaves into her, what, 13 best-selling cookbooks now?
13, yeah. Amazing.
And of course, the narrative from her show. We're also drawing quite heavily from the anticipated themes of her upcoming memoir, Be My Guest.
Right, reflections on food, community, and the meaning of generosity.
That's the one. And another really insightful summary called Be Ready When the Luck Happens. So our goal here is to really try and capture the depth, the warmth, the candor of the story she seems poised to share, and you know what it might mean for anyone looking to build a life around what they truly love.
Absolutely. Our mission today is to understand Ina Garten's incredible transformation. It's really about the sheer guts it takes to step away from a path that looks great on paper, you know, prestigious, but is actually deeply unfulfilling.
Yeah.
And then to find your true calling in something as fundamental, as elemental, as feeding people. What we discovered is, well, it's a masterclass in meticulous work for sure, but also in taking calculated risks.
Big risks.
And holding this unwavering belief in the power of human connection.
Just think about it for a second. Imagine spending your days deep in high-stakes nuclear energy policy. For the White House, no less.
Right.
And then, one day, you decide, you know what? I'm walking away. And not just walking away, but building an entire culinary empire. You know, brick by delicious brick. Basically by inviting the whole world into your kitchen.
It's incredible.
That's Ina Garten's story. And it's such a powerful lesson in building a life, not just around what you do, but what really, truly nourishes your soul.
Okay, so let's unpack this incredible journey chronologically. Let's start right at the beginning. Ina Rosenberg, born in Brooklyn, raised in Stamford, Connecticut. And her home had this a rather unique relationship with food.
Yeah, unique is one way to put it. For her, the kitchen was, quite literally, she calls it a forbidden zone.
Forbidden, wow.
Yeah, her mother, a dietitian, saw food purely as fuel. You know, calories, nutrients, not as a source of joy or comfort or connection.
It almost feels poetic then, doesn't it? That the very space she was excluded from as a child becomes the absolute central pillar of her life's work.
It's a really profound psychological thread, you know, running through her story. And what's fascinating is how that early experience, being sort of shut out from the kitchen, became such a powerful, almost subconscious driver later on.
Yeah.
Her entire career, you could argue, became this determined effort to create the warmth, the generosity, the open door hospitality she maybe craved as a child. It really set the stage.
Yeah, I can see that.
And speaking of foundations, at just 15, she meets Jeffrey Garten at Dartmouth College. This wasn't just like a teenage crush.
Right?
No, this was the real deal. It established the emotional, the intellectual bedrock for her whole future. Jeffrey, apparently right from the start, was the first person to truly see her untapped potential.
That's lovely. So that connection with Jeffrey sounds incredibly formative.
Yeah.
After meeting him, she enrolled at Syracuse University, but then she left to marry Jeffrey when he enlisted for military service during Vietnam.
Right. And while he was stationed over in Thailand, Ina did something really quite beautiful. She taught herself to cook.
Ah, the Julia Child connection.
Exactly. Using Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking as her guide. It's just such a powerful image, isn't it? The kitchen becoming her private classroom, her sanctuary. Cooking as this act of love, a way to connect across thousands and thousands of miles.
It really is.
Yeah. Those early cooking experiments weren't just about learning recipes. They were about, I think, transforming cooking into an act of connection, bridging that distance.
So Jeffrey returns. They settle in D.C. Ina finishes her degree at George Washington University School of Business.
Right. And then she dives headfirst into the federal government. Lands a pretty serious position at the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, during the Ford and Carter administrations.
And specializing in?
Nuclear energy policy.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So she thrived on the intellectual rigor, the challenge. But despite the prestige, the mental stimulation, she felt, and this is her word, profoundly unhappy.
Profoundly unhappy.
Yeah. Deeply disconnected from anything tangible.
Yeah.
She once said, it was a job that was very exciting, but it wasn't me at all. She talked about being in a building with no windows, analyzing a budget, and how it had nothing to do with people.
That quote just paints such a picture, doesn't it? That feeling of being disconnected. So here she is, late 20s, intellectually buzzing, but like emotionally running on empty.
Pretty much.
And then comes this moment that changes absolutely everything. A casual browse through the New York Times classifieds.
Classifieds, can you imagine?
Right, and this tiny ad catches her eye. Specialty food store for sale in West Hampton Beach. The name. Barefoot Contessa.
There it is.
And fueled by this deep dissatisfaction and Jeffrey's unwavering encouragement, his simple advice, do something you love, she decides, yep, on a whim almost, to make a low-ball offer.
A really low-ball offer, apparently.
And to her complete shock, it gets accepted. What a leap.
It truly was a traumatic, almost unthinkable leap. At 30 years old, she walks away from the White House from this secure, incredibly prestigious job,
yep,
for a tiny 400-square-foot shop.
Okay.
In a small beach town with zero formal culinary or business training.
Hmm.
None.
That's terrifying.
She later described that period as her, like, grueling, terrifying, but also exhilarating on-the-job MBA in culinary school, working 18-hour days. Just insane hours.
Wow.
But she built the store's reputation meticulously, focused on quality, simplicity, and creating this really powerful sense of community. That was her crucible. You know, right, where she forged her whole ethos.
And after nearly two decades of that.
Yeah.
That relentless grind, basically.
Yeah, grind is the word.
She sold the store in 1996, utterly burnt out, took a year off to recover. And during that time, Jeffrey and her friends just kept nudging her. You should write a cookbook. Channel this expertise.
Yeah, persistently encouraging her. And fortunately for all of us, she finally gave in.
Thank goodness.
Right. Published in 1999, the Barefoot Contessa cookbook was an instant, like, explosive success.
Just huge right out of the gate.
Totally. Its magic was in its voice, calm, reassuring, elegant, but making delicious, beautiful food seem not just achievable, but actually simple,
yeah,
accessible.
Yeah.
It basically codified everything she'd learned and practiced in the shop, and it just resonated with millions.
And that massive success, in turn, leads to offers from the Food Network.
Yep. Though she was apparently initially terrified, refused repeatedly to do television. She'd guarded her private life so fiercely, the idea of opening it all up, it just felt overwhelming to her.
I can understand that. And yet, eventually she agreed. The show, Barefoot Contessa, premieres in 2002,
yeah,
and it just translated her intimate instructional tone perfectly to the screen.
It really did. It cemented her status as, you know, a cultural icon, and for so many people, like a trusted friend right there in their kitchen. That transformation from reluctant TV personality to beloved host, it's really something.
It is.
The years after that, well, her brand just became a global phenomenon. 13 best-selling cookbooks, nearly two decades hosting the show. And through it all, she fiercely protected her private life, her brand integrity. She consciously kept the business small, manageable, famously turned down countless licensing deals.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because she didn't want to dilute her core message. She chose quality and authenticity over just like massive expansion.
That's discipline.
It really is. And the act of writing her memoir now, opening up about her personal journey, it feels like a culmination, doesn't it? Connecting that driven policy analyst to the relaxed host we know. The girl forbidden from the kitchen to the woman who built this incredible empire from it.
Okay, so let's dig into that. What does all this tell us about her core philosophy, her values? Her worldview seems, I don't know, deceptively simple at heart.
I think that's a good way to put it. Deceptively simple. Hospitality, for Ina, is a form of generosity that creates community. That's the core.
Right.
Food is the medium, the tangible way love, comfort, connection are expressed.
And the cat phrase.
How easy is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not just a rhetorical question. It's like her mission statement. A promise that elegance, deliciousness, it's achievable for everyone, no matter your skill level.
And the other one, store-bought is fine. That feels almost revolutionary in the food world sometimes.
It really is. It's this truly radical permission slip, especially in the often quite judgmental culinary sphere. It basically encourages you to prioritize connection over, like, culinary martyrdom.
Yeah. Don't kill yourself making everything from scratch if it means you can't enjoy your guests.
Exactly. If buying dessert or a sauce means you have more time and energy to actually engage with your guests, enjoy their company, then in her philosophy, that is the superior choice. What looks effortless, she teaches us, actually requires meticulous planning, front-loading the work so the host can be present, relaxed. That's the ultimate act of generosity for her.
It makes so much sense when you frame it that way. But what do you think motivates her at an even deeper level? Beyond just the philosophy of hospitality, what's really driving Ina Garten?
Well, I think at the deepest level, there's this profound desire to create order and comfort. And we can trace that right back to that childhood experience, right? The forbidden kitchen.
Oh, okay.
Her meticulousness, whether it's recipe testing or arranging flowers or setting a table, it creates this reliable, reassuring experience for everyone around her. It's controlled, but in a comforting way.
Right.
And secondly, that intellectual curiosity and drive we talked about, the one she used for nuclear policy, it was simply redirected. She applied that same rigorous analytical mind to the mechanics of business, the chemistry of recipes, the logistics of entertaining.
She's basically a systems analyst for dinner parties.
Kind of, yeah. She's a lifelong learner, totally driven by solving problems, whether it's a multi-billion dollar budget or just figuring out how to get the perfect crispy skin on a roast chicken.
That transfer of skills from government to gourmet, it's really an intellectual insight in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So how does someone so meticulous, so driven, approach adversity? Does she crumble or does she have a specific method?
Her approach seems to be characterized by this incredibly pragmatic problem solving and a really courageous willingness to pivot when things aren't right.
Like leaving the OMB.
Exactly. When faced with that deep unhappiness in her government job, she didn't just, you know, tough it out. She made a radical life-altering change despite the massive risk involved. She seems to view failures not as like personal indictments, but as valuable data.
Interesting.
Yeah. A collapsed cake, a business decision that doesn't pan out. It's just information. Use it to inform a better attempt next time. Her resilience is, it's quiet. It's steady. Disciplined forward motion. She doesn't seem to dwell. She learns. She moves on.
That's a powerful way to operate. It sounds like a quiet strength. Let's talk about the key relationships in her life, particularly Jeffrey Garten, her husband. He seems to be just the bedrock of her success.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. Jeffrey is, you could say, the catalyst for her adult life, a lifelong champion, providing just unparalleled intellectual and emotional support.
He encouraged all the big leaps.
Every single one. Buying the store, writing the book, doing the TV show. He's her first and most important audience, a key advisor. Their partnership is just this beautiful demonstration that you can be incredibly supportive without being competitive, you know?
That's a great point. What about other mentors?
Well, there are the distant ones, like Julia Child, who she never met, but who obviously demystified cooking for her. Martha Stewart, perhaps, who showed an empire could be built on domestic arts, though Ina definitely carved her own much more accessible path.
Right. A different vibe.
Totally different vibe.
Yeah.
And then more direct mentors, like Anna Pump, the original owner of Loaves and Fishes in the Hamptons, who gave her crucial early guidance with the store, and Frank Newbold, her literary agent, who apparently saw the potential for a cookbook before she even did.
Wow, quite a network of support, both seen and unseen. And what about her personal life, her family, the chosen family she often features?
Yeah, she addresses her complex relationship with her mother with a lot of understanding now and forgiveness, recognizing how her mother's actions, however restrictive they felt, maybe paradoxically fueled her own passion for creating that warm, inviting space.
Interesting how that works.
Isn't it? A really significant theme in her story is her and Jeffrey's conscious choice not to have children, which allowed, you know, unique dedication to her career and shaped a different kind of life for them. One that's richly filled with this chosen family of close friends who are always around her table.
Yeah, you see them on the show all the time. Okay, but no one's journey is totally smooth. What were some of the biggest challenges she faced, and what do you think was her secret to navigating them?
Well, often her greatest obstacles seem to have been internal. Her own fear, her self-doubt, about leaving that secure government job, about buying a business with zero experience, writing a book, facing the camera for TV.
All those big pivot points.
Exactly. And then, of course, the sheer physical and mental toll of running the store, the financial pressures, the exhaustion, 18-hour days for almost 20 years.
That's intense. So how did she overcome that fear, that exhaustion?
I think it was incremental confidence building. She tackled challenges in sort of manageable parts, moved forward even when she was anxious, and just kept putting one foot in front of the other. It's that disciplined forward motion again. Just keep going.
Okay. And what about any, like, public controversies? Someone with that kind of profile must have faced some scrutiny over the years.
Her career has been remarkably free of major controversy, which is honestly a testament to how carefully she's managed her brand and I think her genuine approach.
Yeah, seems that way.
The most notable thing was probably a widely reported Make-A-Wish scheduling conflict years ago, which was later clarified as more of a misunderstanding, and the wish was ultimately fulfilled.
Right, I remember that vaguely.
Yeah. And occasionally some people mention, class-based criticisms of her Hamptons lifestyle or the emphasis on good ingredients, but she consistently counters this by emphasizing authenticity, accessibility, and her huge fan base generally sees her as aspirational and authentic, not really elitist.
So the setbacks and failures were more often like in the kitchen or in business decisions
Yeah.
rather than public image stuff.
Precisely. Countless recipes that just didn't work out, business decisions that maybe didn't pan out as expected, like a larger store expansion she considered, but ultimately pivoted away from. Her recovery pattern for these seems really consistent. Analyze what went wrong, extract the lesson, apply it immediately to the next try. She doesn't dwell, she learns and moves on. That pragmatic resilience is just such a hallmark of her journey.
Okay, it's clear there are so many universal human lessons we can pull from Ina Garten's remarkable life. What stands out most to you?
Gosh. So many. Well, first, definitely that reinvention is possible at any age. I mean, she made her life-defining career change at 30. It proves it's truly never too late to pursue a passion that's calling you.
That's a big one.
Huge. Second, define your own version of success. She walked away from external prestige for internal fulfillment. It shows that real success is about engaging your soul, not just collecting titles or external validation.
Right.
Third, generosity can actually be a business model. Her entire brand is built on making people feel cared for, empowered, and look how successful it's been.
Yeah, incredibly.
Fourth, the power of a supportive partnership cannot be overstated. Her marriage just highlights the profound impact of having a partner who encourages your risks, believes in you, provides that safe harbor.
Jeffrey, again.
Always Jeffrey. Fifth, discipline is the foundation of creativity. That seemingly effortless style she has, it comes from immense discipline, from mastering the fundamentals behind the scenes.
Yeah, all that prep work.
Exactly. And finally, authenticity creates sustainable success. Building your professional identity around what you genuinely love and value creates something far more enduring, more resonant than just chasing trends.
Those are truly incredible insights. It really shows how her path, while unique, is also deeply relatable. Okay, let's wrap up with our three final takeaways from this deep dive into Ina Garten's world.
Okay. An emotional insight that really resonates, I think, is that the entire empire of Ina Garten was fundamentally built on a foundation of just two people, Ina and Jeffrey, who simply profoundly believed in each other. Their 50-plus year love affair isn't just a sweet personal story. It's really a testament to the transformative power of that unwavering support,
Yeah.
the kind that says, "Yeah, let's go look at that crazy ad in the paper." It makes every adventure seem possible.
That's beautiful. And an intellectual insight that's really fascinating here is that people often see the cozy kitchen, the beautiful garden, right? But they miss the brilliant mind that actually built it all. The very same analytical rigor she applied to those multi-billion-dollar nuclear energy budgets was meticulously aimed at deconstructing a chocolate cake or streamlining a dinner party. She didn't abandon her intellect, she just redirected it from policy to pastry. It proves that high-level skills are profoundly transferable to the most unexpected and delicious fields.
Absolutely. And finally, here's a universal insight for you to maybe ponder. Imagine writing your resignation letter from a secure, prestigious job at the White House for a tiny food shop you know nothing about. It sounds insane, right?
Totally insane.
But Ina Garten's story asks us this fundamental question. What if that insane choice is actually the only sane one for you? Her life teaches us that perhaps the greatest risk isn't in leaving a predetermined path, but in staying on it long after, deep down, it's no longer truly yours.
Wow, Ina Garten's story really isn't just about food or recipes, is it? It's truly about the ingredients of a well-lived life. After listening, maybe take a moment to consider your own recipe. What passion have you perhaps left simmering on the back burner for too long? What store-bought shortcut could you give yourself permission to take just to make more time for what truly matters to you? Perhaps the first step is as simple as inviting someone over for dinner. How easy is that?